Recording live from the Hoban Law Group here in Denver, Colorado, I'm your host, Eric Singular. We're sitting alongside president and founder of the Hoban Law Group, Bob Hoban. We're just having a one-on-one, and before we jump into the topics that we're going to discuss, I just wanted to draw attention and highlight and celebrate that perhaps one of the silver linings of COVID and this pandemic is that we have gotten Bob Hoban in the studio to record. We're on about episode 75, 76. It's a wild thing. And without COVID, with your travel schedule, Bob, we never would have gotten the opportunity to have you on here with so many excellent guests. We were talking to Patrick earlier, and he kind of brought this to light, that to have you share your perspective on all these different topics that we've covered, it's just been an awesome thing to be a part of, to watch. And so it is. There are silver linings. We talked about this from day one of the Hoban Minute of COVID. This is certainly one of them.
No, it certainly is. Positivity has always been something that, you know, we've all just kind of kept in our mind throughout people losing their jobs, people getting ill, people dying, and some of the other things that are obviously going on in the world. But just trying to keep a focus on what's next and, you know, how to make things better around you has been a focus. And this has been a pleasure because I was thinking about it for the last 3 years, Eric, 20 plus countries per year, all business travel related, 20 plus a year, never thinking I'd go to 20 countries in my life, let alone a fraction of that. And having been in Colorado, with y'all in particular, but just being here for all this time, it's been pretty special. And you said it before, what makes it special is the guests, right? The folks that we've gotten on to give different perspectives of what this industry is, a little sliver here, a little sliver there, because the message that we want to tell is that this is a sophisticated, professional industry full of hardworking people that really care. And we've done quite an excellent job of showcasing those people for folks that don't know a lot about this industry.
Well, and we talked a lot about slowing down, that this has been an opportunity to slow down. And while I think I speak for at least myself and our producer, Halston, that we have not slowed down at all, especially in the production of this show, it's been a slowdown in the sense that, you know, you got to slow down and we got to take advantage of your time a little bit. And it's led to a beautiful thing, which is all these episodes and a bunch of great conversations that we've gotten to be a part of and that we get to share with everybody out there.
You've said it before, by the way, the notion of when we're older, whether that's 10, 15, 20 years from now, and you're talking to children or friends or whatever the case might be, it's, you know, what did you do during COVID? What's your COVID story, so to speak? Not to make light of that as a topic, but what is the story, right? What did you do? This is something that we've done together for months now, and obviously we'll always remember it. But the fact that we brought people in from all over the world to talk about what was happening in real time, that was pretty darn special. Getting that and trying to, you know, hopefully share that with the folks that do listen in.
Yeah, no, super cool. Thinking about Javier down in Argentina, thinking about just the different methodologies that we've heard from our guests. You wouldn't know otherwise how certain countries reacted to this, the different measures that were put in place. It was, it's been a fun journey, and hey, we're not slowing down. We're gonna keep going. Shifting.
Too much of everything is just enough. That's usually what they say.
Shifting gears here just a little bit. I want to talk about Bill Barr. This is a pretty new story. Several members of congressional committees expressed concerns over the Justice Department allegations from a whistleblower. Whistleblowers have always been a controversial subject matter, but this was specifically some whistleblower allegations against Bill Barr around improper antitrust investigations into marijuana business mergers. And it's an interesting topic. But I think what's
what's improper about that, by the way? I don't understand.
Well, Good question, because they're saying this is taxpayer money, a waste of department resources going to look at the cannabis industry. And perhaps what the real issue at stake here is, if you're using taxpayer money, sure, and you have Bill Barr, you have your attorney general putting resources towards this, it's almost legitimizing. You're almost putting some legitimacy on the industry. This, and whether or not there are antitrust elements, I can't speak to that at all. Perhaps you can. But I think it's more of a perception thing. It's a perspective thing. Why is our federal government allocating money and resources into something that is not federally legal? Does that not open some questions around legitimacy and, you know, funding money? I don't know.
Or is that the reason that they're investigating, or at least the face on its face legitimate reason to open such an investigation, because of the illegality, the violation of the Controlled Substances Act element? The fact of the matter is that there are a number of things that the Department of Justice does, investigates, pursues on a monthly, weekly, annual basis. And unfortunately, that position appears to be more highly politicized than it's ever been. And it's naive to think that political agencies, for example, the Department of Justice, would not be politicized, or it's abnormal to think that that it would be just a normal working environment in the federal government. But we've never had it, I think, such in our faces, that these positions and what they do is so highly politicized. Hence the investigations perhaps into the marijuana industry. You'd have to look at the timing of those alleged investigations. The timing and the subject matter of the deals. Was Jeff Sessions still around? Did the Cull memo exist? What about the spending prohibitions in the federal budget? I mean, there's a lot of ways to look at this thing through a legal lens. But to your point, and this is always the optimist, there's something good to look at through everything. It does, in fact, legitimize an industry that, in the face of illegality, is conducting large-scale national, if not international, mergers and acquisitions, and the federal government is investigating it or examining it, but has taken no action thus far. That, in theory, legitimizes the industry and establishes a form of precedent. Ultimately, the industry needs all the friends it can get in Washington, D.C., and if by reviewing these deals and understanding that they've happened in a logical manner with real professionals involved, documented properly, disclosed properly, if those things all occur and they don't stop, interfere the transaction, or bring some sort of criminal action related to it, doesn't that effectively sanction that behavior and recognize the industry as something that they didn't think it was? And maybe it garnered some respects, probably the wrong word, but, you know, recognition as a real thing?
Well, there's been a lot of talk. And on this subject of federal legality, there's been a lot of attention put on federal legalization. We've talked about it on the Hoban Minute. And there are more and more people saying, hey, this is a Depression era-like time. This is a time when we need a new commodity. We need something that's going to invigorate the economy. And federal legalization may be entering into the forefront. But while all of that may be well and true and very, very positive, something to be excited about, I want to temper that for a moment. This is something we've talked about. I don't think we've talked about it on the Hoban Minute, but I want to talk about potentially what is something we don't anticipate that could be a negative consequence of federal legalization. And I look specifically at Canada, because Canada, when they legalized across the board, and they ran into a number of challenges. So what is something that somebody who's out there who's thinking, man, if we had marijuana legalization at the federal level, wouldn't that be great? What is at least one thing that you wouldn't anticipate, but that could be a potential pitfall of that?
If the federal government were to legalize marijuana in theory, and based on history with nearly every other commodity product industry, it would insist on creating very onerous rules and regulations for operation. in an industry that's already squeezed with cash, already squeezed with debt from infrastructure build out, and increased competition where prices have been lowered. Federal legalization could create a reverse effect of not creating opportunity for people that want to operate in the industry, but rather eliminating opportunity or consolidating the fact that hundreds of people, if not thousands, can exist in a regulated industry today in terms of owners that own multiple things. But in an economy governed by the federal government, it would be consolidated and limited to a very exclusive pool with a lot of capital that were able to comply, that they had history with, the so forth and so on. So I don't know if federal legalization, that includes regulation, would have a good consequence. So I do believe that the idea of the States Act, which has been discussed, in part sponsored and crafted by our state senator, Cory Gardner, who I think has been very pragmatic and reasonable in his approach to cannabis, particularly as Republican. When you look at the States Act, it says if a state has a robust regulatory structure and it's making sure everything happens within the state, enforceable, and teen use and so forth and so on is not on the rise, DUIs, that kind of thing, then it's not illegal under federal law. We're not going to change the Controlled Substances Act. We're going to create an exception. We're going to let other states determine whether they want it or whether they don't. Let's not force it upon federal regulation. Without the onerous federal regulatory component I talked about a minute ago, that could work. It could work. Then you still have the problem of scheduling. Because if marijuana as a substance is rescheduled, then in theory, it has recognition as being medicinally beneficial. Because number one, schedule one, no medicinal benefit, high potential for abuse. So if it's two or below, it would indicate that marijuana has medicinal benefit, and therefore it would open it up significantly, the floodgates, to new drug applications by pharmaceutical companies, studies, research, so forth and so on related to marijuana, which would also leave dispensaries or over-the-counter marijuana in limbo, because that, by virtue of rescheduling, would not be made legal just by virtue of that. You would still be selling something that's a scheduled substance, and that requires compliance with federal law about how you dispense pharmaceutical-based substances or controlled substances. That creates an increase in cost and changes the structure dramatically. So my point is there's really no right answer at the federal level, but I think it's small steps before large steps, and it's dubious whether either one of our presidential candidates would make any progress in this front. But as we've talked about as a law firm, we very much see cannabis and the cannabis industry as people that can effectuate good social change. Cannabis and the social issues that are going around on around us with incarceration at, you know, disproportionately larger rates for minorities tied to marijuana and things of that nature. This industry not only owes it to make some change and forced to make some change, but it has the capability to do it. And a lot of that starts with policy change. So that's the momentum that this industry needs to come up with. It needs to not be so divided over every single issue and understand that no matter what your take is on this industry, you're trying to advance something that revolves around a plant that creates so much opportunity, provides so much for people and the environment, and is the common bond between all the folks working in and around this industry. And if you keep that channeled positively, you can make that social change around policy change around the plant, which has social impacts on racial injustices and so forth and so on. And that's what we need to see more of. And federal policy change can drive that.
Let's talk about a potential stepping stone. We had a guest earlier today who raised a point that I thought was kind of interesting. It was that Fortune 500 companies, because they are national companies, are likely going to be discouraged from entering this industry until there is federal legalization. And it made me start to think about, one, the multi-state operator model. It made me start to think about, two, why a national company, what that distinction really is, and then multinational organizations. So if you're a multinational organization, what are you limited by? My question to you, just for a little bit of clarity's sake, is if the Safe Banking Act, which is a pretty moderate step, but would essentially be a nod to, hey, even though this is not federally legal, we are at least going to respect the state's right. We are going to respect and honor and really not take any steps of action to make the financial side of everything feel a little bit more comfortable and a little bit less risky. Do you think that the Safe Banking Act would encourage the Fortune 500s, these people who operate more on that federal legal tier, I guess, would it make them more encouraged, or is it really federal legality that they are waiting for? Or maybe you disagree with the whole point, and really it's just that there's too much risk assessment on the side of the Fortune 500s that's preventing them from dipping a toe in.
So the Fortune 500 companies, accordingly, are used to working within industries that have a certain level of clarity, that it's that clarity that they require. Now, does this Safe Banking Act create clarity? The Safe Banking Act creates clarity for banks to allow them to service industry operators, and in a backdoor, indirect way, creates opportunities for institutional banks to begin to move towards public listings in American-based stock exchanges, even though the text of it says that that's not what its intent is. That will be a ripple effect of that. But that gives the industry access to capital. That doesn't solve the problem of clarity that Fortune 500 companies require, and that is stable regulatory environment, clear rules, friendly with regulators, distribution outlets that will standardize and use their standards as the guidelines by which they put those types of products on their shelf. Those things are coming. Their attention is here, as we've heard and we talked about, Fortune 500 companies, but it's those roadblocks that prevent it, absent very specific, energetic direction from above. If you had an executive or a new CEO or a board that insisted that company examine its philosophy surrounding cannabinoid products, for example, of any shape or size, and insisted that they integrate that and advance their exploration on how to innovate products with those and or using hemp for other uses, then you'd have a change. Otherwise, it's an organization that's built to function like a machine in its existing lanes, and without clarity, I don't know if the Safe Banking Act alone solves that problem.
So anybody who has interacted with a Fortune 500 or just a large box store, large company would know, they're coming after us, that the legal teams of these companies are the ones who really require the due diligence, the ones who really raise the red flags and to some degree stifle the ability for these folks to put stuff on the shelves. So here's my question to you, and this is not meant to be a plug of the Hoban Law Group, but perhaps it might be, which is, as a law group that's been functioning in this space for 10 years and understands, and I think this is one of the big distinctions between the Hoban Law Group and another law group that doesn't interact with cannabis and the industry at large on a regular basis, they don't have the institutional knowledge. They don't really know. And so they look at this and they see huge risk, and the rewards are just eclipsed by that risk. So what is it from a legal perspective, the legal teams that guide these big companies? What's the message to them? Maybe there isn't one, but I'm just going to probe a little bit, because on a recent call I had, this is the concern. The actual executives, the high-level senior leadership, they were on board. They want to see these products on the shelves, but they are deterred entirely by the legal team, and they're kind of at an impasse for how to get through that hurdle. Short of education and offering some kind of hemp 101, CBD 101, or even marijuana or THC 101, that's really the stage that they're at. So from a legal perspective, what can you do, or maybe you can't do anything, to move that needle a little bit?
when you, as a lawyer, when you do research, particularly on a topic that you're tasked with understanding and you may not understand that area of the law, you go out and you read everything that's humanly possible. You read the laws, the statutes, the legislative histories. You read press recaps on what was happening. You want to understand why the words on that piece of paper got to where they are. Unfortunately, there's not a clean repository for that type of information as it relates to laws surrounding industrial hemp or marijuana at the state or certainly at the federal level. So they go out and they see what's on paper, and the lawyers say, this is either gray or it's black, or there's just no guidance from above in terms of direction. And the lawyerly thing to do is advise the client of the risk. And the risk, because of the lack of regulation, not legality, of CBD, for example, in the United States, is too much. So how can you get around that? You provide that color, that background, that context. You do your best to provide all of these different sources and tell the tale how things have evolved. You track enforcement patterns. You track dialogue with government agencies. You work with agencies to enact policies versus legislative reform and put those things in writing that talk about how they're going to allow commerce in this industry to exist. These are all strategies and things that lawyers within the industry can do and can help provide to lawyers from these larger companies evaluating the subject matter. But the problem is, because it's a lawyer's job to paint the entire risk picture, as I mentioned before, they are not incentivized necessarily to go out and find that information that provides context and color, nor do they really care, because the words on paper are really all they need to know, and it's not the clear picture that they would like. So it's a challenge, but you need entrepreneurial, business-minded leaders to innovate products in those large companies. It's not going to come from within the organization necessarily.
Well, it's a fascinating answer, and just really kind of paints a picture of where we are at right now. And of course, this is a law group, and we have to explore. It is our responsibility to explore what a non-cannabis law firm and what that legal perspective is, aside from having all of the institutional knowledge that an organization like the Hoban Law Group has, how they come at this. I think it's interesting to hear you kind of talk about it from that side, because we often hear you speak and hear your perspective, which is someone who understands the intricacies of all of this, and you are the embodiment of that repository, whereas another person would go and find that repository somewhere. You carry that with you almost everywhere you go, and you bring that perspective and shed light, in the things that you do. So, Bob, we thank you for that. But I want to bring our attention for a moment to a controversy here in the state of Colorado. And we don't have to get too much into the weeds on this, but the Colorado Department of Agriculture, which put together and it wasn't even the Colorado Department of Agriculture. The state put together an initiative by the name of CHAMP. And this initiative was meant to bring together stakeholders in the hemp industry who would set the table for what was needed in order to position Colorado as a leader in industrial hemp. And they brought together 8 different areas. This included transportation. It included extraction, processing, genetics, a range of different categories. And they had a bunch of excellent folks, people who have been in this industry and understand it inside and out. And one of the resulting recommendations of the CHAMP initiative was to put together a center of excellence. What a center of excellence is a little bit nebulous. It's a concept that we use outside of the cannabis industry. It is something to funnel,
to drive funds into, to be used to advance research and development and the use of technology to advance industries that have a lot of promise.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but it's one of these beautiful entities that exists somewhat in the public and somewhat in the private sphere. You're using resources and funding from both. And thus, it's a pivotal thing. And of course, this center of excellence was slated and designed to foster innovation here in the state of Colorado and continue to position Colorado as a leader for industrial hemp. Okay, so the state, the Colorado Department of Agriculture, puts out a request for proposal. And a couple of organizations put in those proposals, and a group wins. That group has now been called into question. And so what I want to just kind of talk about for a moment is when you look at this center of excellence and you look at what the state, what is the real objectives of this organization, this center of excellence, and you look at what the controversy is around the group that got awarded it and why there might be some conflict there in whatever way, shape, or form, what exactly is needed? What are the intricacies that we're dealing with here, the sensitivities that have led to this conflict? And ultimately, there is a goal, there is a vision for what this thing could be, and how do we fulfill that vision? How do we meet it?
Well, the government's always in a challenging position when it has to select openly and honestly and evaluate different candidates for a particular government award. In this case, there were five applicants, and what the particular company that received the award had worked with the Department of Ag previously on the CHAMPS initiative, to your point, and also has a history of working with other governments, working with other divisions of our state government here in Colorado, and particularly the Marijuana Enforcement Division. And from the outside, it seems to have performed well. And there's controversy that underlies all of this. Forget about the particular applicant. And I haven't looked at the application. I'm unaware of specifically how they proposed, what they proposed. But we know the folks, and we know they've had government contracts before, and they appear to have succeeded. What's needed here is a group that can tie together the academic world, the private sector, the government, and reach out to different elements, different trades, different verticals, if you will, that attach to that particular industry to share information and to begin to get people to know one another. That central clearinghouse for that information, someone that will make sure that those folks are working together and talking together. And by doing so, drawing government dollars from the federal government, available from our Department of Ag at the USDA, so many other different ways, from private scenarios in conjunction with universities and state systems, as I mentioned. Somebody that has experience doing that is what's needed here. But somebody that also understands the evolution of the hemp industry in the, 5, 6 years we've had hemp growing here in Colorado. Someone that understands that history, the challenges, the regulations, the emerging regulations, the changing regulations, the different personnel, what's going on in other states, what the federal government's response has been. All of that is critical to shaping a center of excellence that functions. It's one thing to be a great technocrat and to be able to say, I can get all these folks to work together using this formula and this structure. But you need to understand how the industry works to be able to piece those things together, to channel those dollars into the right places, to create innovation and opportunity, which is what's required to get government support and industry support before investment dollars and those large institutional entities come into this space. And trust me, that's what we want, because then we'll fully realize with infrastructure and otherwise the 50,000 uses of this plant, which is, you know, where we need to go, not get fixated on the low-hanging fruit right now.
Well, and I think you really, you hammer home the essential point, which is this is exactly what we've always wanted. This is exactly the kind of thing that we have needed to accelerate the hemp industry and to really understand that this is the new commodity. And yet here we are trying to take a step of action, trying to get there, and there's controversy. And perhaps
trying to convince a company that uses grain for billions of units of product in years, and they don't think of hemp as a alternative grain. those are major challenges that this industry needs to address. And to your point, it's going to require somebody that can tie all those things together. You can't guess at it.
Well, I'll put this to you before we sign off. And it's, I don't know, maybe there's no good answer, but hemp is agriculture. That is kind of what is at the heart of this controversy, is that we know what industry and what commodity and what sector hemp really falls underneath. And that is, it's agriculture. This is an agricultural commodity, and it should be treated as such. And that's why organizations like the DEA and anything that is indicates that hemp maybe is somehow related to marijuana, there's a line in the sand. No, this is agriculture. This is for the farmers. It's for rural communities. This is for we know what it is. But here's the question. What is marijuana? Where does marijuana fall? If we know that hemp is agriculture and an agricultural commodity, and it will emerge as a global commodity in that sector, where will marijuana fall? Is it going to be a pharmaceutical commodity? Is it going to be, as you said at the very beginning of this, if we had federal legalization and we rescheduled marijuana, it would throw into question the entire recreational over-the-counter model. Marijuana seems to be more complicated, and it seems to be at the heart of this issue where you have people who are trying to make that divide and classify hemp as agriculture. What the heck is marijuana?
That's a great question. When you go back to the four policy, public policy lanes that I always try to hammer home here, nutraceutical, pharmaceutical, over-the-counter marijuana, and which is the dispensary system effectively, and then, of course, industrial uses, you have to look at what lane marijuana falls in. And you want all four lanes to exist. That promotes maximum use of the plant. It enables the most people to access the benefits of the plant, and it creates the most economic opportunity for people to have jobs and to work in something that's an industry. And by the way, when you talk about agriculture is the industry, really, I was just thinking out loud to myself, and that was, is there a corn industry? Is there a wheat industry? Or is that the agriculture industry? It's one crop therein. I don't necessarily have an answer to that, but it paints a color on how you perceive these things. But if you go back to those four policy lanes, as I was talking about, I think that the idea is marijuana fits in the over-the-counter lane because you always want people to have access to flower, marijuana flower, meaning above 0.3% THC, as high as, you know, in the 30s or 40s sometimes, concentrates, edibles. You want people to have access to all of those products, because those products might work better for people, whether that's for medicinal or just adult use. And those should be made available. We've come too far to not have that be the norm. But if you're a pharmaceutical provider and you need THC, do you grow a marijuana farm, which will be highly, highly regulated always, grown indoors, small batches, highly concentrated, highly specialized genetics, or does THC simply become an ingredient, a controlled substance-related ingredient or a highly regulated ingredient, but an ingredient nonetheless that simply comes from something that people plant thousands and thousands or hundreds and hundreds of thousands of acres of or millions of acres of? That would be industrial hemp, as we've talked about, taking the THC out of the plant and any other cannabinoids. And when you have thousands and thousands of acres of something, you can aggregate those cannabinoids. You can isolate those cannabinoids and use those as ingredients for formulas in the, you know, FDA-approved or that equivalent sector, the pharma sector. So the future of marijuana is a bit fuzzy, much like the plant, of course. But it will certainly need to stay on the path of its existing system for distribution in its natural state, but also recognizing that pharmaceutical companies and supplement manufacturers are also going to sell equivalent products. That's why the more lanes, the more access for people to have this product, this plant, in different ways, and the more jobs it creates and the more opportunity it creates for this to be recognized as a proper major ag cash crop.
Oh. Those lanes are essential, and without them, Bob, we end up busted down on Bourbon Street, set up like a bowling pin, my friend. Signing off here from the Hoban Minute.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Hoban Minute. Do you have any ideas for episode topics or guests? We would like to hear from you. Reach out to us at media@hoban.law, and stay tuned for more on the Hoban Minute.